From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. Yesterday was a pretty good day for Republicans loyal to Donald Trump. Five states held primaries Tuesday, and several candidates in South Carolina and Nevada who backed Trump's false claims about the 2020 election won. Let's go to both states. First, Gavin Jackson hosts the public affairs program This Week in South Carolina on SCETV. Hi, Gavin.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. So two Republican House members earned the ire of Donald Trump. Congressman Tom Rice was one of 10 Republicans voting to impeach after January 6th. He said he voted his conscience, but Tom Rice lost his primary last night. Did that impeachment vote come back to haunt him?
Oh, yeah. That was definitely the only reason that he lost. That was something that was a culmination, a career-defining vote for him, 10 years up there in Congress, representing the 7th Congressional District in South Carolina. And it boiled down to one vote, and the man, he knew what he was doing when he took that vote, even though a lot of people thought he did that accidentally. But he said he'd do it again. He has been on message ever since January 13th saying that he would do it again. And mostly because he was just so disturbed by President Donald Trump's lack of leadership during that day on January 6th. And a lot of people really give him a hard time for that, but he said that he just couldn't stand for that and voted his conscience. And the backlash was swift and immediate back then. He was censured by the state party. Friends became foes, and he's been on the ropes since then. And, of course, he got knocked out last night, the first one.
In a separate race, Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace survived. She voted to certify the Biden election victory, though not to impeach President Trump. Why did she win, you think, even though Tom Rice did not?
Yeah, that was a different race, a different district. So Nancy Mace is down there in the Lowcountry. She represents the Charleston area, Beaufort, a lot of those areas, which is just further down the coast from Horry County and the PD, where you're seeing Tom Rice in. So different socioeconomic status there, different voters, different kinds of folks involved in those races. And again, Nancy Mace really did a lot of talking immediately after January 6th on cable news, slamming the Trump administration, but she did not vote to impeach him. And that's really a huge difference in this race. Now, she did face a challenger, Katie Arrington, who was backed by President Donald Trump. But the big deal there was that she lost that race in 2018 to a Democrat, Joe Cunningham, who just won the Democratic nomination for governor last night.
Yeah.
And Nancy Mace did not let folks forget that she lost in 2018.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Joe Cunningham, the Democratic former congressman. So he's up for governor after yesterday's primaries. It will be Cunningham against Henry McMaster, the Republican incumbent. How is this going to play out in the general election? What are we going to hear?
Yeah, you know, it's very difficult to run as a Democrat statewide in South Carolina. We haven't had a Democrat win as governor in 25 years plus. So it's going to be very difficult. It's an uphill battle, of course, but he had an interesting primary where he was branded as being Republican light, you know, that's running for this more moderate approach. But, you know, he's also a consensus builder, and he's working to try and project what he did down there in the 1st Congressional District and make it a statewide flip, where he flipped that district for that was Republican for more than 40 years, and he's hoping to do something similar in the entire state, which will be very difficult. You know, we are not Georgia. We are not North Carolina. We have a lot of new people in the state as well, so it's an uphill battle for him.
Okay. Gavin Jackson hosts a public affairs program This Week in South Carolina and SCETV. Gavin, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, Nevada also saw victories for candidates who supported the false claim that the 2020 election was stolen. KUNR reporter Bert Johnson is in Reno. And Bert, Adam Laxalt, the former Nevada attorney general who did embrace lies about election fraud, won the Republican Senate primary. He'll face the incumbent Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto. This race, you know, could decide the fate of the Senate this fall. So just how convincing was that win?
I mean, he did really well. He had the Trump nomination, of course, and he did really well in terms of fundraising on top of that. He cleared the primary with more than half of the Republican votes cast.
Yeah. Well, let's look at the race for governor. Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo won the Republican primary with Trump's endorsement. He'll face another incumbent Democrat, Steve Sisolak. What kind of chance does Lombardo have in the general?
You know, polling in a hypothetical matchup between those two has shown an advantage for Sisolak, but Lombardo is sort of seen as a candidate who could bridge the gap in terms of bringing some folks who might be disaffected, who might be nonpartisan voters or might be, you know, Democrats who are upset about the way that the COVID-19 pandemic was handled here. That's really been a central message of his campaign. Lombardo's been leaning on a lot of those anxieties, and he's been blaming Sisolak for lost wages and economic stagnation.
Hmm. Well, you've done a lot of reporting on how many local candidates for state offices in Nevada are now backing those false claims of election fraud. Just tell us a little bit how extensive that is.
You know, it goes pretty deep. With my colleague Tabitha Mueller from the Nevada Independent, I looked into all of the state races, and candidates from about a third of districts that were up for re-election this year support the big lie. And it goes beyond the state house, of course, but, you know, that was a really significant number. We were kind of surprised to see that many.
Well, you got Jim Marchant, who won the GOP primary for Secretary of State. He's a former Nevada state lawmaker, also a proponent of the lies about the 2020 election being stolen. He would be in charge of Nevada's future elections, do we understand, if he wins?
Yeah, most definitely. That's also really significant because the incumbent Secretary of State, Barbara Sagavsky, is actually a Republican herself. She's termed out. She can't run again. But she stood up to the Trump campaign and defended the integrity of the vote here in Nevada. So it's been a pretty big priority for Trump allies to get someone who will toe the party line into that office. And on top of that, of course, the state legislative candidates who are running on the big lie will also be in a position to pass policy that affects voting, too.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, that completes our look at two states that had primaries yesterday, South Carolina and just now Nevada, with KUNR reporter Bert Johnson. We'll, of course, continue to follow all election news. Bert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To the UK now, where the British government is still trying to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda. This is a highly disputed plan. And yesterday, a first plane bound for Rwanda sat on the tarmac. And minutes before takeoff, it was stopped, following a ruling from the European Court of Human Rights. Let's get the latest now from reporter Willem Marks. He's in London. Willem, hi.
Hey, Scott.
So some 28,000 migrants last year crossed the English Channel, which is a huge jump from the year before. What is the migrant deportation plan, this deal between Britain and Rwanda?
Well, it was an agreement signed a couple of months back between the two governments. And as part of the deal, some of those individuals who've arrived in the UK through what British authorities term unsanctioned routes and have sought asylum upon arrival, they'd be sent to Rwanda and offered the opportunity to apply for asylum there. The UK would pay Rwanda tens of millions of dollars for what essentially amounts to an offshoring service. And Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government has said it expects this new deportation policy will discourage people from trying to travel to the UK to lodge their asylum claims. This year alone, you mentioned 28,000 last year, already there have been more than 10,000 individuals who've made that dangerous crossing from France to England on those small boats. Just yesterday, the Ministry of Defence recorded more than 400.
Wow. Yesterday, also, a European court intervened in the middle of all this, and it set off a series of events. What happened?
So several British courts over the past week have declined to block that first flight scheduled for yesterday. The London High Court last week confirmed it would undertake an extensive review of the legality of the entire policy, but that won't happen until next month. And what the European Court of Human Rights decided last night, very last minute, frankly, for some of the individuals that were still on that plane, was that until that judicial review next month is completed, it's not fair to send people to Rwanda who may not then have a legal mechanism to come back if this policy is found to be unlawful.
Now, the UK government of Boris Johnson still wants to proceed. What are representatives of the government saying today?
They've said they are already planning for the next flight, Scott. They are undeterred but disappointed by that ruling. Many of their critics, though, say that this policy is unworkable, it's unethical. And you've even had senior members of the Church of England saying that they're not happy with this policy, they don't consider it to be particularly humane. And the challenge is, of course, when the government says this is a deterrent, is there any evidence that that's going to work? Not yet. So that remains to be seen.
And I just wonder, you mentioned some of the opponents of this, including the Church of England. Tell us a little bit more about the debate inside the UK, in the neighborhoods, how people talk about this, debate this.
One of the big concerns that people have expressed is that Rwanda is not necessarily a country that will provide the same environment as the UK to support people during their asylum process. And so something that people talk about, and this is reflected very often by human rights groups in particular, is that Rwanda stifles political opposition to some extent and won't necessarily provide the facilities, the economic opportunities down the road that the UK itself seems to offer people. Mm. The Rwandan government, as you might imagine, refutes this and says it will welcome them. But that is a concern a lot of people have expressed.
Yeah. Well, the Rwandan government is, of course, receiving a lot of money for doing this. That's Willem Marks reporting from London. Willem, thank you.
Thanks so much, Scott.
In recent days, rumors about Russian President Vladimir Putin's health have swirled with little to back them up. But if scenes from Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake start playing on Russian TV, Russia watchers say that's the sign all is not well. Russian state television played Swan Lake for three straight days in 1991 when there was a coup attempt against Mikhail Gorbachev, in the 1980s when three different Soviet leaders died and no one knew who was taking control, Swan Lake played again. And today, Swan Lake is also played by those protesting Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So what is it about this ballet, which, we find out, has more than one ending? Bryn Shaivitz is a professor in the dance department at Chapman University in Orange, California. Bryn, professor, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And remind us, for those of us who may vaguely remember, yes, there is a prince who falls in love with a swan, but the swan turns out to be a woman trapped in the body of a swan. Can you just flesh out very briefly the synopsis of Swan Lake?
Sure. So there is a prince, Siegfried, and Odette is supposed to be sort of the good swan. And long story short, she is madly in love with Siegfried. Siegfried is madly in love with her, but because of a spell cast upon the two, an evil swan, a black swan known as Odile, tricks Siegfried, and depending on which version you're watching, there are numerous endings, and either the two of them, Odette and Siegfried, commit suicide together and then live happily ever after, kind of in the afterlife, or sometimes Odette dies in Siegfried's arms, or sometimes it's just a matter of good over evil, and Siegfried defeats the evil sorcerer, and all is well.
So we will talk more about the choreography and why there are all these different endings. But first, when you wrote about this in Newsweek, I noticed that there were comments from people saying, oh, come on, you know, this is serious, there's a war going on. Really? Swan Lake will be played? You firmly believe that. I mean, that history says it might be.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, this has happened so many times in history. When Brezhnev died in 1982, and when Andropov died in 1984, and Chernenko in 1985, the Russians played Swan Lake on state television, and then this happened again in 1991. And then it became more of a political symbol just to kind of signify that there was some sort of political shift.
Swan Lake can be weaponized by all different kinds of people. We saw recently TV Rain, which was the very progressive, fact-based television station, which was shut down by the Kremlin. They played Swan Lake as they went to dead air, except for Swan Lake. Before we find out why you think maybe Swan Lake, let's find out more about it. It was considered a flop when it premiered in 1877 in Moscow, but a huge hit when it was revived in St. Petersburg in 1895, when much of the famous choreography by Petipa and Ivanov for the Swans debuted. Let's listen. So, Professor Shaivitz, we understand that the production ended tragically. both the prince and Odette the Swan woman die. Tragic.
Stalin actually really, really hated this very tragic ending. So they played the tragic ending for a while, and then in about 1945, they decided they just wanted something super happy because the idea was that audiences liked happy endings because it made them more optimistic about the world. And so Siegfried actually just defeats the evil sorcerer, and then and all is well. So there doesn't have to be, you know, the loss of love or the loss of life or anything. It can just be that good triumphs over evil.
Well, when you mentioned that Stalin didn't like the tragic ending, he also airbrushed people out of photos. He didn't want, and so if he didn't want something, it didn't happen. So then what happened? I mean, how long did the happy ending play in the Soviet Union?
And it wasn't until much more recently, I think 2001, is when the Bolshoi Theater started returning to kind of the more tragic ending. And the version that most people perform, both in the United States and kind of across Europe, is this Petipa and Ivanov version that has the two kind of committing suicide together, Siegfried and Odette committing suicide together and then living happily ever after in the afterlife.
Okay. But what is it about Swan Lake that has led it to play this role when something happens at the Kremlin?
It's an excellent question, and I think it's really hard to know for sure. But I would say that it boils down to what it represents, both in terms of Russian tradition and Russian ideology. So on the most basic level, Swan Lake has been viewed by Russians as sort of the purest form of classical ballet. So that means both the music is very kind of like pure classical Russian. The choreography is that as well. So I think there's an artistic explanation for why Swan Lake, and it has to do with the music itself. It's written by Tchaikovsky. He's a Russian composer. It's this symphonic masterpiece that has so much potential for choreography. When you add to this Petipa and Ivanov's very distinctive and dramatic style, there's an opportunity for kinship between Tchaikovsky's score and, you know, the visual offerings, the choreography. So many authors have discussed the swan scenes as being kind of emblematic of a choreographic symphonism. So this is where the choreography itself starts to kind of mirror the music. And so the ballet's narrative and the bodies on stage are going to respond to the kind of pathos of the music. And Ivanov's floor patterns tend to be very symmetrical. So then the movement itself represents this idea of a mass of bodies. And you can think about, you know, some of the famous scenes where it's all the swans, all the whole corps de ballet on stage at once. And this, and Swan Lake's not the only ballet that has this, but this is kind of a very powerful image of all the swans moving together in unison. And it's also highlighting the group rather than the individual, which during a time when communism is so popular, is going to be more popular amongst the people kind of controlling art in the Soviet Union. So it embodies, the ballet itself embodies a kind of idealized nationalism. There's something, I mean, if there is so much kind of Russian pride associated with the ballet, you know, I think the hope is that everything is fine. I think a lot of people associate going to the ballet with their childhood, and that there's something, there's just something nostalgic even about watching the ballet that I think can be soothing or calming for people. You know, ideology aside, Swan Lake has this long history of being political. So I mentioned earlier, Stalin hated the tragic ending, but he actually loved Swan Lake. So I think he saw it upwards of 30 times. So I think his personal interests set this precedent for ballet throughout the Cold War. And then because of its history and popularity within Russia, or the Soviet Union, Swan Lake was used to kind of prove Russia's cultural legitimacy. When anybody was coming to visit the Soviet Union that was of any political importance, they were taken to see the ballet Swan Lake, like maybe taken out to dinner and then they would see Swan Lake. So even somebody like Nixon, when he was vice president, he was taken to see a performance in the late 1950s, and Fidel Castro, when he came in the early 60s, it was just part of the itinerary, and I think it was a source of pride for the Soviet regime, and then also sent this message that the USSR isn't backwards. We're extremely, you know, quote-unquote, cultural and steeped in art and value art.
Wow. You know, for anyone who thought it was just a dance, you know, I mean, it, there's so much there. And yet, you know, we're wondering what it says about the Russian people. Now, for many of us, we got to see Swan Lake with legendary dancers and defectors like Nureyev, or more recently, Mikhail Baryshnikov. These were Russians dancing this piece of culture, and yet they had left the Soviet Union. They had fled that culture. So it was. It seems like it might have been used in some ways against the Kremlin. We're wondering if it also says about the Russian people, you know, this is a very tragic ending. And there's some sense of a country united in that pain somehow. And we're seeing that right now. You know, Putin is saying the world is against you. I'm just wondering if there's some attraction in the tragedy.
I do wonder that. There's almost like a paradox in these dancing ballet bodies, and I'm just wondering whether, you know, that there's just always something going on that we're not aware of. And I think the ballet dancers are aware of one narrative, and I think the people who are censoring or putting things on state-run television programs are aware of that we're not aware of. And so I wonder, you know, like what narratives are being talked about and what narratives are not being talked about.
Yeah. Well, and we should add, we mentioned Mikhail Baryshnikov. He wrote a letter a few days ago to Russian President Putin, slamming him. He writes, "Your Russian world, the world of fear, the world in which they burn Ukrainian textbooks, will not live on as long as there are people like us, the true Russians, immunized in childhood against this plague." Whoa. Bryn Shaevitz, a lecturer in the Department of Dance at Chapman University in Orange, California. Is there a part of Swan Lake that you'd really just love us to hear?
Yeah, so the classic pas de quatre that the Four Swans do dancing, it's made memes and kind of, it's all across the internet these days, Four Swans dancing en beauté together.
Like little leaps, little galloping leaps where their little toes come up.
Yes.
And you point out that when Russia, was it Crimea? When Russia seized Crimea, there were four swans dancing among tanks. So meaningful to Russians. Professor Shaevitz, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oregon has one of the most ambitious climate plans in the country. It completely phases out the use of fossil fuels to generate electricity by 2040. But cleaner renewable energy comes with a challenge. Most plants only generate power when the sun shines and the wind blows. Monica Samayoya from Oregon Public Broadcasting visited a facility that uses batteries to help solve this problem.
In rural eastern Oregon, rising from bright yellow wheat fields and framed by snow-covered mountains, there are hundreds of giant wind turbines and solar panels generating clean electric energy. Unlike fossil fuel power plants, there's little noise, just the gentle whooshing of wind turbines. And the occasional sound of a motor adjusting solar panels to track the sun. Walk closer and you can see what's unique about this power plant: batteries to store electricity. You can also hear another sound.
The high frequency, you're hearing the inverter, and then you got fans blowing.
Jenna Lane with NextEra Energy Resources says the inverter makes it possible to use the energy generated as electricity in homes.
From our inverter, we can go out to the grid, or we can go and charge our batteries. And then at night, when we don't have any sun to produce power, we can push power from our batteries through our inverter out to the grid.
Portland General Electric started operating this first-of-its-kind power plant in March. It generates up to 350 megawatts of clean energy, enough to power about 100,000 homes. The batteries store enough to power about a quarter of that for 4 hours. The utility's director of sustainability strategy, Kristen Sheeran, says adding batteries increases the reliability of clean energy resources.
You are seeing the next iteration of battery storage technology and the ability to integrate that on site or near site to where, you know, wind and solar energy is actually being produced. So I think you're going to see more of these types of facilities in the future.
The state's main utility watchdog group supported plans for this plant. Bob Jenks is the executive director of the Oregon Citizens Utility Board.
This is a good example that we can move to a clean energy system. We can get emissions out. We can deal with climate change. The technology is not the problem. The technology exists.
Jenks says to meet Oregon's clean energy goals, there needs to be a diversity of renewable resources and flexibility. He says adding batteries helps provide both. But he says battery capacity can decline over time. The utility says as technology advances, the facility is already built to handle more battery storage. Jenks says weather is another variable that affects batteries.
Anyone who owns an electric vehicle knows that in the winter, you don't get the same amount of miles as you get in the summer.
Still, Jenks says the facility is good for ratepayers, and he hopes it will change when, where, and how clean energy is created and stored across the state. Portland General Electric expects to build more power plants like this one, enough to power about 500,000 homes by the end of the decade. For NPR News, I'm Monica Samayoa in Lexington, Oregon.
June is supposed to be a time for LGBTQ plus people and their friends to show up and celebrate their communities. But last year, the groups organizing Philadelphia's largest LGBTQ plus celebration disbanded. There had been issues for years, and they culminated in accusations of racism and transphobia. As it turns out, issues at Philly Pride aren't unique to Philly. Groups in many cities have struggled. And critics say they feel unwelcome in these organizations, in part because of the presence of police groups and big corporations. Let's talk to Michaela Winberg. She's host of a new podcast from WHYY. It's called March On, The Fight for Pride. Michaela, hi.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So your podcast goes into persistent problems that followed Philly Pride. You know, tell us about them.
Sure. Yeah. Well, everything sort of came to a head last summer in June of 2021. The organization that ran Philly Pride for almost 30 years, for a few decades, collapsed. They disbanded because they had posted a few statuses on Facebook, of all things, that got them into some hot water. So in one of them, they posted what looked like a Blue Lives Matter flag, but with a rainbow stripe instead of a blue one. Hmm. So, you know, of course, that drummed up some controversy among
people
who
don't... What is the Blue Lives Matter flag? What is that?
Yeah, the Blue Lives Matter flag is... It's sort of a black and white version of the American flag with a blue stripe in the middle.
Okay.
And it's come to represent everything from support for police to white nationalism, sometimes the Proud Boys. So
I can see
it's a controversial thing to post.
Yeah.
So then the organization posted another Facebook status, and this one referred to the Stonewall Riots. So for those who might not know what the Stonewall Riots are, that was in 1969 when a handful of LGBTQ patrons at a bar called the Stonewall Inn in New York City fought back against police. They were conducting a lot of raids of gay bars at that time, and finally the patrons had had enough, so they decided to engage in some resistance. And that was really how Pride started in this country. So the organization in Philly posted about the Stonewall Riots, and they referred to the trans women who led that resistance as those dressed as women, which sort of implies that the trans women weren't actually women, just dressed like them. And that's obviously a pretty offensive and controversial thing to post.
Yeah.
Shortly after that, there was a lot of community backlash, and the organization disbanded pretty abruptly.
Well, let's talk about Naima Sanchez, someone who appears in episode 2 of March On. She says she has never felt welcome at previous Pride festivals. Let's take a listen.
I've been outside the gates of Pride Festival because I couldn't afford, as a queer youth who was experiencing houselessness, actively using and, like, couldn't even provide my basic needs to pay a Pride $15.
Okay, so what does Naima's story tell us about what seemed to be deep roots of exclusionary behavior by Pride organizers?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people felt that way. You know, one of the big problems that Naima mentions is the price tag. You know, the obviously you can't charge for a parade, which is in the public space, so people could watch the parade for free, but the Philly Pride Parade for years would end with a festival that cost money to get into. So naturally, that creates a problem for people who can't afford the price of admission and sort of decides who in the community can celebrate with each other, you know? And in a marginalized community, that was seen as pretty problematic. And there were a lot of issues that kept people out, whether it was intentional or not. You know, the elevation of corporations and the fact that police were often allowed to march in the parade, those are things that can be alienating for LGBTQ people, and specifically LGBTQ people of color.
Well, I want to ask you about corporations and their presence, their footprint at Philly Pride. You spoke to some attendees about this, and let's take a listen to what they told you.
Like, I've seen the more corporatization of Pride over time, and it's not great. But at the same time, these things cost money. You want to be able to pay everyone here. And everyone who performs here does deserve money. And like everyone that works hard at this does deserve to have to be compensated for it. So it's kind of a push and pull. I wish we could just take money from the corporations and not do anything. Yeah. We would just get their money and distribute it and that's it.
So help us understand a little bit. What is the big pushback at corporations perhaps having too much of a voice to many people?
Sure. Well, that is a major conversation in the LGBTQ community right now. You know, a lot of these pride parades across the country have sort of become what people think of as more of a marketing event than an actual pride parade. You know, there are huge corporate floats for corporations like, I don't know, banks or beer companies nationwide. Mm. And it seems like the bulk of these parades now are made up of these corporate floats. And I think that's really frustrating for a lot of LGBTQ people who feel like these corporations only show up for us one day out of the year. When we go to work at these corporations, they don't necessarily treat us any better, or they don't provide, you know, certain benefits for LGBTQ people. They don't help keep us safe. So I think there's kind of a call nationwide among a lot of LGBTQ people that these pride events should sort of return to the root of what they're about, which is LGBTQ people, not corporations.
Yeah. And these issues that you come upon when you tell the story about Philly Pride, as far as the challengers, the opposition to corporations, representative of police officers, exclusionary policies, is this just in Philadelphia or is this in other places in this country?
Yeah, it's not just in Philadelphia at all. It's really a nationwide theme. I mean, the same time in June of 2021 when Philadelphia's longstanding pride organization disbanded, Boston's disbanded around that time too. The summer before that, Pittsburgh's pride organization disbanded. And even in the cities where the longstanding pride organizations are still lasting, there are these calls from the community to, you know, change how celebrations look. I mean, there's been a lot of controversy in San Francisco recently. The mayor of that city says she's not going to march in the Pride parade this year because the organizers of the parade don't want police to march in uniform. So that's caused some uproar in that city and this sort of like back and forth between Pride organizations and city officials. So I do think that this is something you're seeing play out in different ways across the country.
Yeah. Michaela, you are you're a white reporter, and much of the activism in this space is led by queer people of color. How easy or hard was it to jump in? You know, we reporters have to parachute in and tell a story and tell it well, get people to talk to you.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly am very transparent about that. I'm a white person, so a lot of the feelings that I've reported on and a lot of the circumstances that I've reported on in this podcast are not things that have affected me personally. So I certainly have to put myself in a headspace to be understanding about stuff that I might not have experienced. That being said, the good news for me is that it didn't really feel like parachuting as reporting can often feel, because I've been covering LGBTQ stories and the LGBTQ community in Philly for several years now. So many of the people who I interviewed in this podcast and who sort of helped me find other sources were people I had been speaking to for years. Oh. You know, the person who sort of had the idea to start a new pride movement in Philly has been my source for at least 2 years now. So fortunately, I have these sort of existing relationships with people. And, you know, at a certain point, it's easy to understand racism when you see it, whether you're white or whether you're a person of color. You can understand how something might affect people and how something changes the tone of the event. So I was fortunate to have a lot of these, you know, queer and trans organizers of color open up to me and be willing to share their stories with me.
Well, as far as your podcast, without giving too much away, how does the story wrap up?
Well, I can tell you in the last episode, we take you to Philly Pride. So the listeners will be right there along with us. We went to the event that this new group tried to form in a year and put together, and they had really lofty goals. They wanted to make this event be different from the prides of the past that were too corporate, that centered police. So, you know, we'll see if they actually did it. We'll see if this sort of scrappy group of activists was able to make something that felt different to the community and was more welcoming.
Michaela Winberg hosts the podcast March On, The Fight for Pride, from member station WHYY. And she's also a reporter for WHYY's digital website, Billy Penn. Michaela, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
A nascent neo-Nazi group in New England is attempting to recruit new members, and it's doing this by raising its public profile and latching onto Republican talking points that were once considered fringe. Philip Martin of WGBH reports.
A video posted last summer on social media provided a rare look inside the strategic planning of an upstart neo-Nazi movement. In the video, Chris Hood, the 23-year-old founder of the Nationalist Socialist Club, or NSC 131, gave instructions to a University of Massachusetts Lowell student named Liam McNeil.
Well, if you're in college, you should be getting together with all the other guys on campus that think like you, circling all the frat parties and bullying the chicks that race mix, and just start dominating the parties, take over the campus.
You could do that.
Hood and 23-year-old McNeil are part of a tiny but growing clique of white nationalists who have begun loudly announcing their presence across New England.
I mean, we're pretty much like a frat, but racist.
Oren Siegel describes Massachusetts-based NSC 131 differently.
It's a small neo-Nazi group.
Siegel is president of the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism.
Those who identify with this group view themselves as soldiers, essentially, who are at war with the Jewish-controlled system that is plotting the extinction of the white race.
Siegel says the group appears to have escalated its activities in the wake of last year's attempted insurrection in the U.S. Capitol, where members of NSC 131 were present. This greatly concerns Gregory Fried, professor of philosophy at Boston College and an expert on authoritarianism.
We should use January 6th as a reality check. Those were the shock troops of an attempted coup on the American political system.
In New England, NSC 131 have hung racist banners from highway overpasses, rallied in front of hospitals, and joined mainstream conservatives to protest vaccine mandates and anti-racist education. The group has conducted martial arts and firearms training in state forests. Law enforcement officials have taken notice, including U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Rachel Rollins, who is coordinating with colleagues in the region.
All of the U.S. attorneys in New England, we've been discussing this, not just with guns running through our various states or human trafficking running through our various states. There's also hate running through our various states.
Rollins has suggested that NSC 131 and other far-right extremists should be classified as street gangs. In January, 30 neo-Nazis rallied near Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, protesting programs to establish racial equity in medicine. The rhetoric of the far-right demonstrators was identical to a patently false assertion made days earlier by former President Donald Trump at a rally in Arizona.
The left is now rationing life-saving therapeutics based on race, discriminating against and denigrating, just denigrating white people to determine who lives and who dies.
Robert Treston, director of the Anti-Defamation League of New England, fears that Trump's amplification of white grievances has helped NSC 131 boost its membership.
And we know this because their demonstration in front of the Brigham and Women's Hospital actually drew more people than we've seen at previous protests.
In March, as floats passed by at the St. Patrick's Day Parade in South Boston, two dozen NSC members unfurled a banner reading, "Keep Boston Irish." Some in the crowd reacted with bafflement and curiosity. Others, like lifelong resident William Good, who is white, were outraged that the group had assumed they would find support in this neighborhood, once a bastion of violent white resistance to school desegregation.
I don't like Nazis. This neighborhood's still recovering from an ugly history of racism, and these people aren't part of my community, and they're not welcome.
NSC 131 received a similarly frosty reception on the campus of UMass Lowell, where Liam McNeil hoped to recruit. A sophomore who would only give her first name, Mary, who was white, said she's not interested.
It makes me wildly uncomfortable, and I think it poses a safety risk for the other students here.
But Awa, a member of the Black Student Union, who also gave only her first name, said that a white extremist presence on campus was par for the course.
Once Trump became president, a lot of people got that courage to come out and show their true colors.
The ADL reported that incidents of white supremacist propaganda more than doubled on campuses from 2018 to 2019 to an historic high of more than 600 incidents nationwide that year. Over the past year, dozens of students have protested McNeil's presence on this campus, saying he should be expelled. But the administration said it could not kick him out because of the principle of academic freedom. Still, the pressure seems to have taken a toll. In a recent phone call, McNeil's father told me that the protest had an impact, and Liam McNeil is no longer enrolled at the university. For NPR News, I'm Philip Martin in Boston.
And you're hearing him on Here and Now, which is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.